One of the things that interested me over the years in ACE was the move from being simply a media specialist to being more a communication advisor. At the time I entered, my first job at Iowa State was as one of two fellows who were to handle the news out of agriculture. We just sort of split it into two sets of beats, one guy emphasizing the animal side, and I was dealing more with the plant side. And it was a matter of writing news releases and sometimes helping with their publications, but really not very much of that. Primarily it was writing the news releases. But as time went on, I think Hadley Reed was the first one to make the move toward the communications person being a broader advisor. He had brought together some very bright young men in his department, and he had assigned them a given set of departments for which they were to do radio writing, news writing, publications, and getting involved in the educational program of the department. But Hadley was a strange fellow, brilliant, and with a strong ego. And I think he found it difficult to turn over to his associates, his staff, that much responsibility, sort of feeling himself maybe left out. So after two or three years, he shifted back. Of course, some of his better people had left. Now, whether it was because of this change or just the ebb and flow of skilled people in the profession, I don't know. But it did not last there. Dutch Elder picked up this idea in the late 50s and applied it only in the agricultural group. At the time, Candace Hurley was the home economics editor, and she was doing this by nature. She had, incidentally, first entered the service at the University of Illinois when Kyle Holtz was the editor there. He left to become editor of Country Gentleman magazine. But anyway, Dutch had three men covering agricultural subjects, and he apportioned the departments out to those three, and we called them departmental editors. And so we worked that way. The individual then became involved with the extension staff of the various departments he covered. He sat in with them as they planned programs. He helped them really across the board planning what they might do as their program. At the time, there was, of course, still one man who was doing ag radio, Dale Williams, and the publications were the final editing and proofreading and contracting was done by a separate department under the information service. But up to that time, the writer had not been very much involved. Now he was. He was the first editor who worked with the specialists in the department in developing the manuscript, and then he saw it the rest of the way through. This worked out, we thought, very well. Dutch left Extension in 1963, and I think I was appointed about 15 minutes later to that post. As time went on, we were able to expand staff a little more, and we added another person to the home economics group, and we were able to make that an area of departmental editor. and the 4-H and youth program. So we were able then to have individuals on our staff serving as communication advisors as well as producers for a given set of departments. This tended to concentrate their work a little more. They got closer in their relationships. I did a paper, I think, at the Oklahoma State meeting of ACE on this idea of being more than a media specialist. Now, not many other places in the system adopted it, but we carried it through to the point that we had all of the departments we served were served by someone who had this additional responsibility. And as the leader in the department, I always made it a point to meet with the department specialists and the editorial person for at least an annual planning program, which allowed us two things really, was to concentrate on the broader program, and the other was to stand behind the staff member that he or she was competent to do this kind of thing and had a role to play. In fact, the one of the things that interested me greatly, the lead man in the agronomy group one time told the director of extension that rather than add a position for another specialist in agronomy, he thought he should add another role for an information person. And that to me was a fairly strong endorsement of the idea that the communication office or the information office was making a significant contribution to the program. I also wrote a paper on this that was in the journal, I think, with the horrible name of communication consultant for that position. But I couldn't come up with another simpler way of saying it. But I contrasted the media specialist, the one who would just write news releases, with a role that I called a program or a contractor who wanted the specialist to come to him and say, I want this. And he would say, okay, go away, I'll produce it. And still, you know, dividing the roles. But I wanted to move on to the next one, in which the communications person's part of planning, deciding what ought to be done, how it ought to be done, and then working with it all the way through to working with the audiovisual people who were doing the specialist production. We didn't expect the writer to become an expert in audiovisuals, but we did think he or she had a role in determining what was going to come out from the audiovisual specialist. This, of course, would no longer fit what's currently done now. The computer and programs like PageMaker have made all the difference in the world. There is no longer a funnel through which publications, for example, go. There was a time that, well, as head of the information group, I was in charge of the full publication budget, and everything that was published with extension funds came through my office, and in a sense through the departmental editors. In fact, based on historical results, we would apportion a given amount of publication support to each extension department. And within that amount of funds, we expected them to exert the primary influence on what they published. But if they were going to need more money than that, we required that they come back and justify what it was. Prior to that time, that extension budget was a free good, and anything you could get out of it was yours to get. Well, this discipline tended to focus them more sharply on what they really needed, what they really wanted. I thought it worked. At one time, I was invited by the assistant directors in the North Central region to come and discuss this idea with them as well. But this was all happening as money was getting tighter, and little happened as a result. But I still look back with some satisfaction on having at least documented the idea. Ace, of course, was having an influence all the way through. I did not have any real contact with Ace immediately when I came here. I recalled probably 1951 or two, the National Conference was in Texas. And what I remember from that is that one of our staff members had imbibed a little too freely on the annual cocktail party that was sponsored by a donor group. See, ACE, regular ACE members had to be part of the USDA or the land-grant colleges. There were others like the magazine people, like Wallace's Farmer, Farm Journal, etc., radio people, public relations people from the dairy conference, the Fertilizer Institute, and so forth. These fellas each year would pool their money and have an alcoholic party for the group. Well, the one in Texas, one of our staff members, I guess, had been a little bit too looped and had made a spectacle of himself. So that's what I knew of Ace at that point. But I think it was probably my second year of full-time work that a Dutch split off part of my time and was devoted to a special project we had from the USDA. This was to develop and measure impact of efforts to use television to get across economic information. A fellow who had been a radio and television producer was the lead man in it. One of the home economists was a technical advisor, and I was in to do the research. We had, we produced, I think it was 10, 15-minute television programs on some economic topic, like it might be buying and using meat, for example. I recall we brought in a representative of the National Beef Association, I think it was, who did a series of presentations on how to do certain cuts of meat and that sort of thing. And there would be, in addition to that, there would be discussion of economic matters related to it. Well, at the time, Iowa State was the only television station broadcasting in this area. It was, incidentally, the first and perhaps only institution to get a commercial license to operate a television station. And in those first years, it had all four networks that it picked and chose from. So if you were watching television in this area, you were watching WOI. And we were interested in measuring the audience for this economic program. And it was made part of a half-hour home economics program once a week. Well, my task was to set up a way to measure audience. Ahead of that, the Ford Foundation had made a major grant to Iowa State and WOI-TV, which was the station, to develop public affairs programs in communities. So there was an area sample. Statistically, the area sampling technique was new. In fact, it was developed by Ray Jessen, a man in the statistics department here. So with that, the state had central part of the state had already been sampled that way, so my job was to select segments, as they were referred to, and go back and review, bring them up to date on who was there. See, under area sampling, you took a given census area and contacted everyone in that area. And this was the method of doing the random sampling. Then we used telephone. Well, first I had to go out and visit the segments and be sure that the people were still there and what their phone numbers were and so forth to validate the sample. Then we had telephone operators who, during the period of 1 hour, would call these samples to find out if their television set was on. There were three programs. First came the Kate Smith Hour, which was an hour of entertainment, then the home economics program, then, the other was a giveaway program where they gave away a fur coat, I've forgotten for what. But anyway, there were these three programs. We were interested in the flow of audience during that period. Our finding, of course, was that education came in third, as one would expect, that entertainment will beat them out. I remember quoting in my thesis, I did my thesis on this research, and the writer in the New York Times had made the point that I'd never thought of, and said that educational television will never be a mass phenomenon, because education is not a mass phenomenon. So anyway, as a result of that, I was invited to make a presentation about it at a regional meeting at Purdue. And that was my first direct contact with ACE, was that at about the same time, Dutch and Hadley Reed, Bry Curl and Harold Swanson, who was head in Minnesota, Earl Richardson in Michigan, had worked out the idea of a regional gathering. And the idea was that we had no trouble getting approval to travel to the state line. And then we would just sneak on across into Illinois and spend a weekend at our own expense talking about ag information. I think Dutch was the chairman of the first one, and the program was basically, what are you doing? What problems do you see? And these were pretty effective. We for one thing, we got to know each other. And there would be probably 45, 50 people there from five or six states. And we were doing that. Then the formal regional meeting at Purdue was where I made the presentation. And then that same year, I went to my first national conference, which was at Berkeley, California, again to present this research project in a presentation there. I even remembered recently quoted one of the opening stories I used there, which I won't bother with now. But at that time, Harold Swanson was the president, Bill Ward was the president-elect, and that was my first experience with ACE as a national group. And shortly after that, I think I was chairman of the research committee, which didn't amount to much. The Wisconsin guys were doing some research. In fact, Phil Titchener, who was one of the people there who later was a teacher in the Minnesota program. But anyway, we had at least a research session about what was going on. I think that was my first formal involvement. I had the opportunity to go to several national meetings after that, not all of them, but several, began to get acquainted. And I think it was the early 60s, somebody asked if they could put my name in as a candidate for director. I had no anticipation of being elected, so I didn't bother to go to the annual meeting, which was at the University of Illinois. It wouldn't have been that difficult, but anyway, I didn't go, but was elected. And then became vice president, and then president. The year 1965-66 was my year as president. And ahead of that, the regional idea had begun to develop. When I was on the board of directors, I made the first motion, made the motion that gave money to the districts, or the regions, to support their activity. I think it was the grand sum of $200. But this could help them get a speaker for a conference or something of that sort. Hadley Reed and I, I don't know whether, I think it probably started with me, a round robin. I had seen this happening in my own family. I think it was a sister-in-law's family who started it. And this is one in which the first person writes a letter of what's going on. The adaptation in ACE was, what are we doing at Iowa State? What are new projects? What's worked well? And so forth. You know, just two or three pages, which we then sent to Hadley at Illinois. He added pages of what was going on at Illinois, and the two pages then went on to a third state, and there were 12 states in the region. When it came back to us, as having done the first one, we pulled our old material out and put in a new batch. And so this circulated around the region. Then, before long, I think Hadley got the idea of a newsletter. And so we began to put together a newsletter and ask somebody in each state to report this and that and the other. And so the regions, up to that time, the regions really didn't amount to much. It was primarily a national group who got together once a year, often making it at a place and time when they could bring families, and it became a vacation, a stop on the family vacation. We stayed in university dormitories usually, minimum cost. One time they were complaining in our region about the cost. I don't know where it was, but, and so I said, well, we can do one at minimum cost. So we got the state 4-H camp, and I think it cost $8 per person for the two nights and the catered meals, which were pretty bad, I agree. But we did it at low cost. Probably it was the last one of low cost. For one reason, it was the Iowa 4-H camp is over on the Des Moines River, about 15 miles from the closest bar. And this became a negative, I guess you'd say. But anyway, region began to become important because we began to understand that not everybody can go to a national meeting, yet everybody has a good reason to have something back from ACE. They were paying actually $5 a year to be members, you know. And so the regions began to get more important. When I was president, I don't know if this had begun to happen before or not, but I attended each of the regional meetings that year, one in Colorado and one in Hot Springs, Arkansas, Washington, D.C. I don't remember the others, but anyway, I think my own institution supported it. When you asked if you could be supported if you became president, the university usually said yes. And so you were careful on how much you spent, but you used it for things that you thought were of some significance and importance. And in my view, the regions became perhaps the more important professional development opportunity. which was the interaction, meeting other people and either formally or informally finding out what they're doing, what's working, and so on. It struck me that there was another place that still not everybody was getting to, a regional meeting. So during my presidency, I decided that each quarter our group would meet in a combination social and professional development. And I invited them to our house for the first time. And we had maybe half an hour, 45 minutes on professional topics. And then it was visiting. And so this, I think, became the first indication of a regular kind of local meeting. In the meantime, in ACE, we had identified state representatives who were formally appointed and recognized as a link back to ACE. But still, the national meeting carried a lot of the emphasis, but a relatively, well, I suppose maybe up to a fourth of the people would get to them. This still meant a lot of people who never got there. Several times, ACE has taken a hard look at itself. The year that I was past president, the then president, Al Bond, from Washington, appointed a committee on the future of ACE, and I chaired that. Ralph Reeder was one of the members of it, and we never got together, but we did it by correspondence, and I invited certain papers on certain topics, and put together at the end a thing that I labeled Odyssey, the log of Odyssey 2. There had been a Future of ACE committee earlier, and this was the second. So I just gave it the name of Odyssey 2. It was about as well organized a trip as Odysseus did himself, but it didn't take us 20 years to do it. While I was in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin, this was the year 57, 58. That was the year that the National Project in Agricultural Communication was started. And I had been invited, along with several others from there, to go to Michigan State to help in planning that first conference. George Axon was one. He had been head, he'd been in one of the New England states, and then it had been in the first group at the Extension Center, Wisconsin, and then I think went back to Michigan as an administrator. But anyway, George Axon was there. Several others, I don't remember now just who they were, but helping Michigan State get started in planning that first communication workshop, which was the first contribution back to the membership. And that was the one that sort of made a national appearance and reputation for David Berlow, a name that may or may not be known to people in the current generation, but the Berlow model of communication was developed for that. That project was developed. It was a two-week workshop, as I recall. We did not get to participate. Our dean, who was formally the director of Extension, was one who was very close with the budget. If something was justified in his opinion, fine. If there was any question, he didn't want the money to be spent. And there had been a subsequent planning conference that involved at least four of us from Iowa State. We had gone at Iowa State expense to East Lansing, and dealt at some point with the final project being developed. And he said, well, our people developed the project. Why do they need to go get the training? So we didn't go, but the rest of the country did. And this project basically put across the behavioral background for communication. And this was the one that really excited Ralph Reeder. I've never seen a person who so wholly adopted a concept as he had there. In fact, he took a year off and went to Michigan State to study there. I don't know if he actually took a degree or not, but he spent a year at Michigan State covering himself in the concepts of behavior in communication. See, his previous work before he went to Purdue had been with the Alumni Association in Nebraska. He was a writer and whatever with the Alumni Magazine and that sort of thing, I think. But he became perhaps one of the strongest advocates of this approach, which then went across the country, and it was followed by a writing workshop and a visuals workshop. NPAC existed, I think, for 6 or maybe 8 years under grant from the Kellogg Foundation. Then at that point, it ceased to exist. But one thing a lot of people don't know, people who know the name Everett Rogers for his books on diffusion, don't realize that NPAC and ACE were a major contributor to his career. He was a young fellow who had done his undergraduate, in fact did his doctoral work here in sociology with Dr. George Beal, who was one of the founders of the literature of diffusion. Everett Rogers was at Michigan State when ACE had to close out NPAC. Well, one part of NPAC had been a research unit, and John Parsi was the director of that. He had collected at the time 521 reports, published and unpublished, of information related to diffusion and communication of agricultural information. And here was these files of that information. So it was given over to the Soc Department, Rural Soc at Michigan State, in which Everett Rogers was a rising young star. And it was out of those materials that his first book came out, I think 1962. On diffusion. Then he wrote several later editions, keeping up with the literature, plus branched out into many other sides of it. And that research unit in NPAC also created one of the most interesting newsletters I think we've ever seen. It was first called Ag Research. And for that, they would take a given topic, say diffusion, for example, and they looked through all the studies that were there, and from them they would bring out certain propositions. In diffusion, for example, things about as the adoption proceeded by stages, from the innovator, the early adopter, the early majority, and so forth. They would draw these conclusions from the research and give it a rating in terms of how sure are we that this is true. And they would have a version as essentially proven, probable, then in doubt. this brought to the ACE membership a treatment of a given topic of importance to them with the research background. And this went on for two or three, throughout most of the life of the project. And I'm sure they're in the library somewhere, and it would be interesting to get back and find them and see how they have held up over the years. I have always considered that ACE through NPAC sort of gave David Berlow his national stage, and for a time he was sort of the crown prince of communication research. He was prominent in the Society of Communication, which put out that huge annual journal each year, and later became president of one or more universities. But anyway, NPAC was really the introduction of a scientific base. Not everybody used it, but it was the base on which many then went on to graduate school, following an interest that they had developed there. A number of the PhDs in the field, in Missouri, for example, Delmer Hattasol and Dick Lee, I think, got their inspiration out of NPAC to go on to further graduate work. But when the grant money ran out, well, that was the end of the program. Early to mid 70s, we got interested in it again. I think Delmer Hatch of Pennsylvania was president at the time. He appointed a committee, which I chaired, on looking into the possibilities of a return of the national project. Well, we knew that there was no probability of putting together a project of that nature. But the thing that we came up with, we wanted to put together a three-year project in which we would go back, we would get people like Everett Rogers, who was still living at the time, and maybe Berlow or one of his followers, but several people who were currently writing in the field and researching, bring them together for about 3 months to see what we could do in terms of catching up with what's happened in the behavioral sciences since the end of NPAC. The outcome of that committee looking into the possible revisiting of NPAC unfortunately came at a time that funding was tight with donors and so forth, but we made an effort. Don Wells had been a graduate assistant at NPAC years earlier, had advised graduate students at Iowa State for a number of years. He was in Washington, D.C., working in one of these personnel exchanges at the same time I was there. He and I put together this three-year project that we wanted, I mentioned a bit ago, of having several people current in the field put together workshops to present throughout the country for a short period of time as the way of bringing us up to date in what was going on. Our project would have taken about $3 million, as I recall. Don and I made a trip to Battle Creek, Michigan, but were unable to interest Kellogg in returning to the project they had originally done. And so that was virtually the end of it. I mentioned earlier of spending 6 months in Washington reading, essentially catching up what had been happening since the days of NPAC in marketing, in communication theory, in well, you name it, the various facets of human behavior related to communication, and produced that one document that became an issue of the what was then the Ace Journal. I don't even remember the number of it, but it would have been, I guess, probably published in 1980. I must go back and read it again, see whether it makes any sense at all now, 28 years later.